You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to the program, A Good Book. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close, and I am also the author of the book I will be reading. The title is Late for the Bus, An Adoption Story, Finding My Birth Parents, Jerry and Joanne Bus. The true story of finding my birth parents after years of fruitless searching, only to discover that I am the eldest daughter of Dr. Gerald Bus, the multimillionaire, legendary owner of the Los Angeles Lakers, and his wife, Joanne. The foreword is written by Johnny Bus, co-owner of the Lakers. The book is self-published by Book Baby, copyright 2022. This is my personal story. In this book, I share my feelings, experiences, and memories, recalling them to the best of my ability. I have changed the names of those who wish to remain anonymous, and I have left out some names and events as appropriate for privacy. We begin with the foreword by Johnny Bus. I have a big sister. I am pleased to write the foreword to my big sister's book about her life and the big surprise of her having four full-blooded siblings and two half-siblings, all younger than herself. After a long time of searching and utilizing the internet and many ancestry companies, she found where she came from. She came from two wonderfully beautiful people, our shared mother and father. The moment I was faced with the fact that I had a big sister, after believing for over 60 years that I was the oldest in the family, I couldn't wait to meet her. It was just like out of the news stories of long-lost family members reunited. You never think it would happen to you. Only a few people in the world knew the truth and amazingly kept it secret for so many years. I can attest that I had no idea my mother and father had a child before me and never once mentioned even the possibility. I couldn't wait for the moment of meeting my big sister and quickly flew to Sedona, Arizona. Of course, no one knows how something like this is going to play out. There were so many maybes that raced through my mind before we met. Will my big sister be nice or maybe not? Will she be bitter or angry? Maybe she'll be just like me. Who knows? Until you really meet. I can tell you, meeting her was a beautiful and amazing experience. We hugged for what seemed to be an hour. I felt as if I hadn't seen her for a year and knew her very well. It felt as though we actually grew up together, but we didn't, and her story is incredible. I felt so close to her that at times I wanted to reminisce about times when growing up together. Remember when we went to Disneyland while it was raining? Oh, wait, we didn't get to share that, but it felt like we did. I am so proud to be the little brother to my big sister. She is a delightfully calm, sweet, kind, and beautiful person, and there's a lot of catching up to do. Enjoy this book with all your emotions and try to feel what it felt like to meet a big sister that you never knew existed. Johnny Bus, Los Angeles, California, March 5th, 2022. I am the eldest biological child of Jerry and Joanne Bus. I was conceived in Wyoming sometime in the month of December, 1952. Although they were married, Jerry and Joanne chose to place me for adoption at birth in California through a private physician. I went home with my adoptive parents when I was 3 days old. I had no idea who my birth parents were until I was nearly 65 years old. When you discover you are the biological daughter of Dr. Gerald Bus, the multimillionaire legendary owner of the Los Angeles Lakers, who also has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, well, it can take your breath away. It has certainly been a challenge to process it all, including the knowledge that I have no legal claim to the Bus family wealth. The seeds of this book begin in my journal years ago, writing about the hope of discovering my birth family, which has always been important to me. As a young child, whenever I looked into the mirror, I would wonder if anyone out there looked like me. My childhood was filled with several interstate moves. Each move and each school became the reference points in my life. Recalling events was made easier through journal entries, a well-traveled box of vintage family letters, and other correspondence, as well as stacks of photos. Before they passed away, my adoptive parents told me stories about their early lives. Current conversations with my adoptive sister and what she remembers and her perspective on our childhood have also been helpful. Thanks to my membership with Ancestry.com and the generous help of a friend who is a genealogical wizard, I have spent considerable time on my biological family tree. I have journaled extensively on the way I discovered my birth family and how it has affected me. Therapy was also a part of my healing journey. In this book, I have changed the names of all those who wish to remain anonymous. However, because it is integral to the story, I have kept the names of my bus family members, who are well-known public figures in the sports world. Detailing my life has been quite a journey, sometimes full of sunshine, sometimes partly gloomy, but always enriching. I have been further inspired by the reading of the works of Brené Brown, a researcher and author whom I admire, who said, "Owning our story and loving ourselves through that process is the bravest thing that we will ever do." I believe she is right. Introduction. Well, you know, she's adopted. I first felt the sting of being adopted when I was in third grade. I loved going to school, but I often got in trouble for talking excessively in class. One day I was politely told to stay after class and stand outside in the hallway. It was a nice day in Phoenix, Arizona, sunny and dry as usual. My teacher kicked the doorstop down to leave the door open as the teacher from the class next door took a quick glance at me as she walked past me and entered the classroom. While they chatted, I overheard my teacher say, "Well, you know, she's adopted." I do not remember hearing another word spoken, and from that moment on, I suddenly felt different, out of place, ashamed and hurt. The words echoed in my mind. Why did she say that? Is there something wrong with me? That moment really hurt, and I developed an invisible wound that, in my mind, would surface from time to time, scab over, and then diminish. But then something would happen to trigger my memory, and that wound would reappear, and I would pick at that scab until it started to bleed all over again. It just never went totally away. Even as a young child, I would ask, "Why did my birth parents give me away?" My adoptive parents never tried to hide from me the fact that I was adopted. I remember knowing this from my earliest recollection. I would often overhear them telling their friends the story of how excited they were when their doctor called to tell them, "I have another little girl waiting for you." 5 years earlier, in November 1948, they had adopted a baby girl at birth from different parents, and now the same doctor was helping them again. In August 1953, when I was 3 days old, my 20-year-old birth parents, Jerry and Joanne, relinquished me and placed me in the care of my adoptive parents, Maddie and Jimmy. My amended birth certificate showed the accurate date and time of my birth, but there was no hospital listed and no attending physician. These two simple omissions would create an enormous obstacle for me later on. The amended certificate did not reflect that my adoptive parents, Jimmy, at 39 years of age, and Maddie, at 40 years of age, were not my biological parents, an outright falsehood on a legal document. Nowhere does the word amended appear. An amended birth certificate is the first lie an adoptee is asked to live every day. New name, new life, new history. Approximately 8 months after an adoption, there is the usual obligatory follow-up visit by a social worker to make sure all is well. The true story of my birth, and that of most other adopted children, erased. As time passes and the adoptee becomes an adult, he or she will sign all future legal documents with his or her amended name. Such legal falsehood makes it extremely difficult for a birth parent to locate an adult child who has married and taken her or his spouse's surname. I have long wanted to know my history, and up until her death at 90, I pressed my adoptive mother for any information she could give me. Her answer was always, "Your father had some papers, but he didn't think they were important, so he threw them out." The only information she gave me happened during a visit to her in the hospital late in her life. She told me that my son, then a senior in high school, looks just like your father, and that your mother had honey-colored hair just like yours. I found it difficult to believe that this was all she could remember about meeting my birth parents during the transfer of my care. My biological father, Jerry Buss, made millions in real estate and purchased several sports teams. Why was it such a struggle to get any information from my adoptive parents? It would take 65 years and Ancestry.com to find a possible reason why my adoptive father discarded my adoption records. Did he throw them out casually or destroy them on purpose? When did he do this? Was it because my adoptive parents felt inadequate in comparison? I will never be able to answer these questions, as all four parents are now deceased. Don't get me wrong. I understand and agree that adoption records are sealed to protect the mother during and after the time she gives up her child. Each state has laws regarding when the sealed record of an adoption can be opened and the original birth certificate obtained by the adult adoptee. Several states have recently changed laws to allow adult adoptees to unseal their adoption records. Whether the results are good or bad, at least the adult adoptee is given the privilege of knowing his or her family of origin, and the healing can begin. And what a difference that would have made in my life. I am now in my late 60s and still have not been given that privilege. I did receive non-identifying information in 1991, but it did not provide any names or specifics to help me in my search. California, my native state, requires a court order to unseal adoption records. When I spoke to a family law attorney in Northern California a few years ago, he politely and resolutely told me that if I were to make a legal attempt to obtain my original birth certificate, citing medical reasons, I would need at least two letters or affidavits from doctors stating that I was in critical health and needed this information quite possibly for survival. Even at that point, he added, it would be up to a judge appointed to review the case to decide how much information would be revealed. Wouldn't you think that at the age of 65, you deserve to obtain your original birth certificate? Not in California. Because of this unfair law, finding my birth family was nothing short of a dead end. For many adoptees, including me, Ancestry.com DNA results greatly increase the likelihood of finding relatives. Unless you are an adoptee, it is difficult to understand the emptiness you experience throughout your life, not knowing your history. When I decided to write this book, I struggled with how to present it. Telling my story chronologically was the easiest and best way for me to get it on the page. In part one, I begin my story by introducing my adoptive parents, Jimmy and Maddie, to get a sense of their early lives, how they met and married and became parents of two adopted girls. As parents, they were much older than the norm at that time, They were, in fact, twice the age of my birth parents, Jerry and Joanne, who were only 20 years old when I was born. For contrast, throughout the book, I interject important life events of the Buss family in between the musings of my childhood, teen years, and adulthood. In part two, I continue my story with the discovery of my birth family and getting to know some of my siblings. This story is more than just a glimpse into my life, but I've tried to keep it more the length of a memoir rather than an autobiography. Writing this book has been an experience like none other in my life. It has been a healing journey and a harrowing one all at the same time, but I encourage anyone who might be thinking about writing the story of his or her life to just start writing one day and see where the story takes you. You may be surprised at what surfaces as well as your ability to bring meaning to all that has taken place. In detailing my life story over the past 3 years plus, I have been better able to process both the pain and the joy that I have given and received. I am especially grateful to my family and friends who have walked this path with me. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. We're reading the book, Late for the Buss. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close. Part 1, Chapter 1, My Adoptive Family, An Introduction to Maddie and Jimmy. Maddie's Early Life. I do everything a man does, only backwards and in high heels. Ginger Rogers. My adoptive mother, Maddie, was born in 1914 in Arden, Arkansas. She and her family moved west to California in the mid-1920s, settling in Los Angeles, a city with over 1 million people. Her father, Carl, gained employment quickly as an elevator engineer for the Pacific Electric Railway Company. Her mother, Mary, was a homemaker. They purchased a home, fortunate enough to escape the poverty of the oncoming Depression. Both Maddie and Faye, her younger sister by 1 year, attended McKinley Junior High as teenagers from 1928 to 1931. McKinley was a large public school in the heart of the city with a diverse student population. In addition to academics, the school placed emphasis on athletics and the arts. McKinley students were proud of their city and learned the order of the streets in downtown Los Angeles by memorizing a poem. From Maine, we spring to Broadway, over the hill to Olive, it's grand to Hope to pick a flower on the way to Figueroa. Maddie loved to recite this poem and did so throughout her life. She taught it to me when I was a young girl, and I still enjoy telling my LA friends this little bit of trivia. In a memory book, a gift from her mother, Maddie saved several certificates she received for school service, dramatics, athletics, and good grades. She loved to draw models in the fashion clothes she had designed, finishing her art with color pencils. McKinley awarded her a blue ribbon in 1928 for an original poster design. A McKinley thespian, Maddie also loved to write plays and act. She played the role of Miss Minchin in the 1931 school play Monkey Business, based on the 1905 novel The Little Princess. She saved a pamphlet from the Carthay Circle Theater, a beautiful Art Deco building that resembled a cathedral, well known for shining spotlights into the nighttime sky to guide moviegoers from all over the city. Showing one particular evening that she attended was William Fox's first movie-tone talking superproduction, Mother Knows Best, and the movie-tone news, Momentous World Events as They Occur. Maddie, tall and athletic, appeared in a local newspaper article as an outstanding player on the girls' basketball team. She loved to dance, and her memory book included ticket stubs to waltz and foxtrot contests at the University of Dance on Slauson Boulevard at South Broadway, the Virginia Ballroom on 54th and South Broadway, the Redondo Beach Ballroom, and the Egyptian Ballroom at the end of the Ocean Park Pier, and others. A talented and beautiful young lady, Maddie turned down many offers to work in offices. Her emerging philosophy, "I want to be out with the people, not stuck behind a desk." Mature in looks and confident in manner at 18, Maddie met her first love, a sailor named Wayne, who was stationed at Mare Island in Vallejo, California. He wrote several love letters to her when she was 17. In one of those love letters, dated December 10, 1932, and addressed to her home on East 43rd Street in Los Angeles, he wrote, "My only darling sweetheart, honey, I received two letters from the one I had this morning. One was written November 21st. Sure took some time to come, didn't it? And I received one stating that your dad was much better. Sure glad to hear it. Precious, this is Saturday night, and I'm so lonesome for the one I love. Oh, say, honey, a friend came aboard just now and gave me a drink of gin. And I took it, the first drink I've had since I saw you. And just think, it's only 8 days till I see the one I love again. Can't hardly wait to kiss those sweet lips again. I love you always, Wayne." This was the last letter from him she saved. She never told me what happened to their relationship or to Wayne, but she would often say, "You never forget your first true love." Life goes on, and as an aspiring professional dancer, Los Angeles was the place to be in the 1930s and 40s. The movie studios in Hollywood secured stars like Claudette Colbert, Katharine Hepburn, Loretta Young, Ginger Rogers, Clark Gable, Cary Grant, Jimmy Stewart, and Fred Astaire, to name a few. Maddie loved to tap dance and admired Ginger Rogers, especially her performance in the 1933 film 42nd Street. That same year, at the age of 19, Maddie was chosen to travel to New York as part of a dance troupe. Besides the arts, much more was happening in Southern California. Route 66, enacted by Congress in 1926, was being constructed. The Summer Olympics were held in Los Angeles at the Coliseum in 1932. Prohibition had ended at the end of 1933, and in 1934, the Moorish Art Deco-inspired Griffith Observatory was completed. Despite the Depression, Los Angeles and its surroundings had a certain glow, and Maddie was in the midst of it all. Jimmy's early life. "And though behind you lies a road of dust and heat, and before you the fear of untried paths, in this brief hour you are the master of all highways, and the universe nestles in your soul." Max Ehrman. My adoptive father, Jimmy, was born in 1915 in the small town of Odds near Waco, Texas. He never spoke about his parents. His father died when he was 6 years old. At this tender age, his mother could no longer care for him and his older sisters, so she kept the girls and sent him to live with an aunt the next town over. Jimmy had a grade school education, and although he did not finish high school, he attended Central City College in Waco in 1936, taking courses in accounting. He also showed proficiency in speech and writing. His first job was working in an office as a temporary. Life in Texas in the mid to late 1930s was not easy, and he, like so many others, was having trouble finding a full-time job. The Great Depression was not over, and unemployment remained high. Newspapers referred to this time as the recession within the depression, because recovery was far from complete. Waco suffered much like the rest of the country. Jimmy was a storyteller and had a natural radio voice. He told captivating and sometimes frightening stories about his young life in Texas. Thunderstorms with balls of lightning that would literally roll across the highway. Recurring images of ranchers burying their cattle during the Depression because no one had enough money to buy them. The luxury of having an orange to peel and eat when few could afford any fruit at all. Hobos riding the rail cars looking for work. The nightmares he experienced as a child after seeing photographs in the morning newspapers of lynching. In his later life, Jimmy would say that as much as he loved Texas, Texas didn't much love him. Relocating to California meant more than opportunity for Jimmy, and as soon as he was able, he was ready to get out of that hard, dusty, and sometimes cruel world of Texas and begin a new life. Saying goodbye to family, he had to travel west solo without the support, financial or otherwise, of his Texas relatives. That's all the time we have today for the program A Good Book. I've been reading Late for the Bus, An Adoption Story. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close. I'm so glad you're listening today. I look forward to you joining us on the next program to continue reading Late for the Bus. We'll pick up where Jimmy meets Maddie. Thank you for listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.